This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said Sunday that U.S. President Trump made the right decision to call off peace talks with Taliban leaders at his presidential retreat because of the terrorist group's ongoing attacks in Afghanistan. VOA's Arash Arabasadi has more.
The Afghan government appeared to support the decision to stop talks.
What the president has said, the president of the United States in his tweet, he has called off. So there's no talks right now. We strongly believe that what he has said reflects the concerns that were raised, not only in Afghanistan, in Afghan capital, but also in Washington, D.C. as well.
Pompeo says the Taliban's uptick in violence trashed months of negotiations.
When we saw this activity, when we saw this action, when we were closing in on a solution and closing in on opportunity for the president to actually meet with the decision makers that can actually deliver that reconciliation and peace to the Afghan people, President Trump said that's enough. We're not going to do that. We're not going to reward that behavior and broke it off.
The stalled talks, at least for now, put on hold plans for withdrawal of the thousands of American troops from Afghanistan. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News, Washington.
Iran says that the oil tanker at the center of a major diplomatic dispute with the United States has sold its cargo, a violation of international sanctions. The ship, which went dark last week, was carrying 2.1 million barrels of Iranian crude oil. It had been detained for 6 weeks by British Marines off Gibraltar in July after it was suspected of violating European Union sanctions against oil sales to Syria. The ship was eventually released over the objections of the U.S. after Gibraltar said it has received assurances that it would not head for any countries under EU sanctions. Since then, the U.S. has pursued the tanker, tried to offer a multimillion-dollar bribe to its captain to turn over the ship, and issued sanctions against its crew. This is VOA News. The history-making storm known as Dorian got in its last lick Sunday before heading into the North Atlantic for its welcome demise. More from VOA's Lattice Hook.
Dorian became a post-tropical cyclone on Sunday as it moved over Newfoundland and Labrador and turned toward the Atlantic. The powerful storm reached the Canadian Atlantic coast on Saturday, knocking down trees, cutting power, and downing a large construction crane in downtown Halifax, the capital of the province of Nova Scotia. Canadian officials say more than 400,000 people in the coastal areas lost power, but there were no reports of injuries linked to the storm. Meanwhile, authorities in the northern Bahamas began evacuating the dead from the Abaco Islands, which were hit by the Category 5 hurricane last week. The government says 43 people died in the storm, but the toll is expected to rise to hundreds after search and rescue teams go through the mountains of debris. Zlarica Hoke, VOA News, Washington.
More political wranglings expected to moving into another week with Britain not having a plan to exit the European Union. On Sunday, members of Prime Minister Boris Johnson's cabinet defended him in his decision to not seek a delay to Britain's departure, although a number of defections within his own party continue to make that a challenge. Reuters' Sarah Charlton reports.
Amber Rudd, Work and Pensions Secretary, quit late Saturday over Johnson's Brexit policy and for expelling 21 rebels from the Conservative Party. EU officials have said Britain has yet to come up with new suggestions to break the deadlock and secure a deal. On Monday, the Queen is expected to sign new legislation into law, which forces Johnson to secure an extension. The Prime Minister has said he'd rather be dead in a ditch than request it. And there are questions over whether the EU would even accept it.
That's Reuters' Sarah Charlton reporting. Pro-democracy activists rallied outside the U.S. consulate in Hong Kong on Sunday as they tried to ramp up international pressure on Beijing following 3 months of protest. Panzer Chan organized the rally.
Hong Kong is the forefront of the battle against the totalitarian regime of China. And this is the forefront of the free world. Please support us. Please support us in our fight.
The protesters called on the U.S. to pressure Beijing to meet their demands. Officials in northern Burkina Faso say at least 29 people were killed in two separate incidents Sunday. 14 people were killed when a food convoy of trucks came under attack in one province, and a government spokesman said that at least 15 people were killed when a truck carrying people and goods rode over an improvised explosive device in another area. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
We'll be right back. Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Monday, September the 9th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. South Sudan rebel leader Riek Machar, who made his first visit to Juba today, Monday, since fleeing the country in 2013.
He's coming to meet President Alpha Kiir Mayardit to discuss issues of concern, especially with the implementation of the revitalized agreement.
The 80-year-old mother of a Cameroon separatist official appears in court tomorrow, nearly a month after being allegedly abducted. The arrest of two Guinea-Bissau journalists highlights the country's alleged lack of free press. And Ugandan police broke up an opposition rally over the weekend.
This is very clearly a political action by the police, deny access to the public by those opposed to the NRM junta.
Dr. Chisa Besigye is a former FDC presidential candidate. A former U.S. ambassador to Zimbabwe will reflect on the death of former President Robert Mugabe and will have an ode to the late Zimbabwe president from Zambia. Those stories plus Samse O'Malley's sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. South Sudan rebel leader Riek Machar could make his first visit to Juba today, Monday, since fleeing the country in 2013. His visit, if made, comes at a time that both the Juba government and the rebels are facing a November deadline to form a power-sharing government, as required by the 2018 revitalized peace agreement. Michael Makwi is South Sudan's information minister.
He will be accompanied by the delegation from the government of Sudan. He is coming to meet President Salva Kiir Mayardit to discuss issues of concern, especially with the implementation of the revitalized agreement. It is worth mentioning that Riek Machar is the only leader who has not come to Juba, but all the other leaders of the other parties are all here in Juba. All the forces have moved to the cantonment site. So I hope that by the time when Riek Machar comes, his forces will be in a position to report to all the cantonment sites so that we move forward.
Minister, you said Riek Machar is the only SPLIO leader who has not come to Juba, but I think he has been concerned about his security. Is his security good now?
We are implementing the agreement in accordance with the mechanisms which were established by the agreement. So the only person who is not here is Riek Machar. Otherwise, the whole of his leadership is here, including his own wife.
You mentioned that he's coming there to discuss some key issues about the revitalized peace agreement. You have a deadline coming up in November. How likely that finally President Salva Kiir and Riek Machar will reach some kind of agreement?
Well, the only obstacle which has been facing us was the issue of funding, and the government has already funded the security arrangement. Chapter 2 is now being implemented. All the forces are in the cantonment site, and the screening has already started. After the screening, then these forces will undergo training, which may be for about 45 or even 30 days because they are not recruits. So they will only go for a refresher training, after which they will deploy. So as a government, we assure the world and the international community that by the 12th of November, the RT Gono will be in place.
You said that Riek Machar, if and when he comes to Juba, Monday or whenever, he's going to be accompanied by a representative of the new government in Sudan. Now that there's a change in leadership in Sudan, what kind of relationship exists now between South Sudan government and the new government in Sudan?
Well, our relations with the new government in Sudan are cordial. They are very good, and we have been exchanging visits. Not that only, but even South Sudan now is authorized to mediate and facilitate the talks between the government of Sudan and the rebels and the opposition parties, which are in Nuba Mountains and in Blue Nile and Darfur. So our relations with the current government are very good. They are cordial. And I'm optimistic that with them now, we will be in a position to make very long strides in the implementation of the agreement.
Can you say, Minister, that the government in Juba is optimistic that the November deadline will be met?
We are not optimistic, but we are saying that it will be met.
Thank you very much, Minister. So nice to talk with you.
Okay, thank you very much.
Michael Makuye, South Sudan's information minister, you are speaking with us from the capital, Juba. The former leader of Uganda's main opposition forum for democratic change says there is no space in Uganda for democratic competition. As a result, Dr. Chisa Besigye says all those in Uganda who desire to liberate the country by democratic means will have to work together through what he calls a people's revolution. He says opposition groups in Uganda are having intense conversations on how to do just that. Over the weekend, Ugandan police broke up a rally organized by the Forum for Democratic Change. Here is Dr. Chisa Besigye.
What happened on Saturday is what happens pretty often whenever we organize political public meetings. There is a law that was passed some years ago called the Public Order Management Act, which law requires that organize a public meeting or a meeting of people of more than three people to discuss politics, you need the permission of the Inspector General of Police. Now, that particular law, however, describes a public meeting to exclude meetings of political parties. No political party that is not NRM, the ruling junta, is allowed to hold the meetings. Not only do they actually stop public meetings, but they have now gone ahead to stop even appearances on radio talk shows by some of the political leaders. So this is very clearly a political action by the police, deny access to the public by those opposed to the NRM junta.
And yet Uganda professes to have a multi-party democracy. How is this possible also as the country prepares for election in 2021?
Well, that is pretty much the situation as it has been for a long time. And I'm sure anybody who has been even casually following the political developments in this country knows that there is nothing remotely that one can refer to as democracy here. So there is no pretense here that there is any form of democracy. It's just a military junta that is very, very thinly veiled as a civilian government.
Dr. Besigye, I'm sure you know about a rising young political person in Uganda. His name is Robert Chakulayi, popularly known as Bobby Wine. Is it possible sometime in the future that you and Bobby Wine and the other political opposition can work together?
Well, definitely. Bobby Wine is my member of parliament where I live, and we have indeed interacted long before he came into politics. We continue to interact even now as he is my member of parliament, and he has already indicated that he intends to run for president. But as I have pointed out, there is no freedom, there is no political space for democratic competition, and therefore it's imperative that all those who want democratic change, who want to liberate the country from military rule, that we must work together and struggle, not just go and cast a ballot in a box held by the junta, that will change the regime. This must be a people's revolution. We must organize people to regain control over the country. And yes, we are having very intense conversations amongst ourselves on how to do that.
Dr. Besigye, thank you very much.
Great pleasure. Have a good day.
Dr. Chisa Besigye is a former leader of Uganda's main opposition forum for democratic change. She was speaking with us from the capital, Kampala. The 80-year-old mother of the spokesman for Cameroon's Ambazonia separatists will appear in court in Yaoundé tomorrow, Tuesday, almost a month after she and her daughter were abducted by government security services. This after a court ordered the notorious State Secretary for Defense, or the SED, to grant her lawyers access. Chris Anu, the spokesperson for the self-proclaimed Ambazonia Republic, says his mother should never have been abducted in the first place.
My mother and sister will be in court on Tuesday. What are my hopes? I don't know whether La République du Cameroun is a country in which anyone should have any hopes in their justice system, because currently you have thousands of their own citizens and Ambazonian citizens in jails all over their territory, including our own territory in Ambazonia. And they have not as much as had a day in court. So my mother and my sister will be in court tomorrow. They are not going to court because the regime has charged them with any crimes. They are going to court because their lawyers have said, you cannot abduct these people and hold them incommunicado, and you cannot charge them. So the lawyers are saying, taking them to court and saying, release them. Do I have any hope that they will be released? We are praying. God still does miracles. That's what we hope.
You should be hopeful because I think the Yaoundé High Court that granted the hearing, and also I think it may have ordered that the lawyers for your mother and sister have access to them.
That is true. Ordering the session, the court hearing is one thing, and receiving justice is just another thing. And with the French Cameroon system, you can only pray and hope that that justice comes, because if we were talking about the Anglo-Saxon system, my mother and my sister will not be in detention in the first place, because the Anglo-Saxon system says they are innocent till proven guilty. And so under that system, they would not be in detention.
Chris Anu is the Secretary of State for Communications of the self-proclaimed Ambazonian Separatist Movement of Cameroon. He was speaking with us from the U.S. city of Houston in Texas. Today's Monday, September the 9th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 17 minutes past the hour. Two journalists have been arrested and held without charges in Equatorial Guinea after interviewing a judge who was fired by the government. Tutu Alicant, founder of EG Justice, a human rights group focusing on issues in Equatorial Guinea, spoke to Ricky Stryak about how the journalist's arrest highlights a lack of free press in the country.
As far as we know, all they've done is their job, you know, go show up somewhere, interview someone and publish or disseminate that interview. As far as I know, there is no law against interviewing people or against broadcasting the interview. So we're interested to see what they're going to be charged with and, you know, then see what type of defense can be mounted, whether it's legal defense or international campaign calling on the government to release them.
How does this show there is very little freedom of press in the country?
Yeah, so in May, the government of Equatorial Guinea appeared in front of the UN Human Rights Council in the Universal Periodic Review. And in fact, September 20th, they are showing up to approve all the recommendations that, you know, they are willing to implement. Several of the issues that we presented to the UN and recommendations were also presented to the government of Equatorial Guinea to that effect were having to do with respecting freedom of expression, respecting freedom of the press, respecting human rights defenders, all these basic fundamental freedoms, right? All of which the government accepted in May of this year. And now, since then, you know, we've had several cases of human rights defenders, of political activists, and now these two journalists, right? Again, it shows how vulnerable people, including people doing their legitimate work, are in a place like Equatorial Guinea. You know, without that, I mean, it seems like a cliche to say that this is a dictatorship, but what bigger sign to show you that, you know, we're dealing with a government that does not respect fundamental rights when journalists show up to do their work, interview someone that, you know, works for the government, because judges in Equatorial Guinea work at the behest of the government, and they are arrested for doing that. You know, it tells you that there are definitely censorship is beyond the pale in Equatorial Guinea.
Tutu Alicante is the founder of EG Justice, a human rights group focusing on issues in Equatorial Guinea. He spoke with Ricky Stryak. Reflections on the late former Zimbabwe president Robert Mugabe continue to pour in from all over the world following the announcement of his passing in Singapore last Friday, with many analyzing Mugabe's legacy. Charles Ray, former U.S. ambassador to Zimbabwe from 2009 to 2012, says while Mugabe, who led Zimbabwe from its independence in 1980 to 2017, when he resigned under pressure from the military, made a lot of mistakes, one can never strip him of his legacy as one of the founding fathers of Africa's independence.
I'm not surprised. I mean, the man was quite advanced in age and in bad health. My condolences to his family. I imagine this still comes as a shock to people in Zimbabwe. He was something of an eternal presence there. But, you know, what I would hope is that the current leadership will reflect on this and mend their ways and put the country back on the track it should be on and should have been on from the time that they removed him from office.
It seems as if there are some people who are actually praising him for what he did for the land reforms.
I think that's a bit misguided. I mean, I don't know. I was only there 3 years, but my observations of what was happening with the distribution of the properties that were either purchased or taken, I wouldn't call it reform. I mean, many of the very productive farms were just laid waste.
So, in brief, you are saying that the land reform program was sort of a disaster, right?
Well, I don't know if I would use the term disaster. I would just say that it was unsuccessful. Yes, a lot of landless people did get land, but a lot of very profitable and productive land was passed along to cronies of the government who basically stripped it of assets and didn't use it as productively as it could have been used. As a net result, the country went from being a net producer, a net exporter of grain and other food products to, well, the rest of Africa and parts of the world, to relying on food aid.
Is there anything that was done by the late former president that you think maybe was a big positive for Zimbabwe?
Yeah, I mean, and this is something I said in a tweet I sent out this morning. He should be remembered for everything he did, both the good and the bad. I think the land reform was a mistake, the way it was carried out. But, I mean, his focus on education, on using the assistance money that came into the country in the 1980s to expand the university system, to make education available to all of the people in the country, women and men, I think that was a great positive. And in the early days, at least in his public statements, his stress on including everyone in the system and sort of forgetting the antagonisms of the past and moving the country forward as a multiracial, multicultural society, I think those were good things. Unfortunately, they just got off track.
And when we come to relations with other countries that, like the USA and others, it seems as if Mr. Mugabe was always challenging the West for this and that, you know. Do you think that he could have handled it in a much better way?
Yeah, I think all sides could have handled it much better than they did. I mean, he was in my experience with him, he was a prickly elderly gentleman who was very strict on protocol and had a tendency sometimes to go off on his little rants, but he could have handled his relationships with other countries much better than he did. I think he'd let his ego sometimes get in the way of getting things done.
Charles Ray is a former U.S. ambassador to Zimbabwe. He spoke with Gibbs Dube of the Zimbabwe service from his home in North Potomac, Maryland. There were prayers on Sunday in some churches in Zimbabwe for God to forgive their departed former leader, Robert Mugabe. The Kenyan Standard newspaper also wrote in its Sunday editorial that Mugabe's death drew strong emotions of nostalgia and loathing almost in equal measure. Here is Peter the Pundit Longu of Zambia with something like an ode to the late Mugabe.
Robert Gabriel Mugabe. Even in death, he raises debate, a polarizing figure that divides brother and brother, like the waters of the mighty Zambezi that separates the two Rhodesian twins. His legacy as murky as the waters of mighty water that separates our lands. A protagonist that turned antagonist or a man misunderstood. They said to know a hippo, you must ask a crocodile. Even amongst Zimbabweans, both at home and abroad, there is no one in unison voice. Others see a man whose heart was in the right place, but whose head made him prey to his ego. His eventual downfall. In a nation where commodity prices are skyrocketing, many look at the now-bred vision of Robert Mugabe in Zimbabwe as the good old days. Were they really good old days, or a case of Stockholm Syndrome? Is Robert Mugabe the last dictator or last liberator, or just the scapegoat for the tyrants across the globe that hold the citizens under Stockholm Syndrome? No matter where you stand on this issue, it is clear that Mugabe will not be easily forgotten. And I won't be surprised if Mugabe makes the Oxford Dictionary, but this remains Blair, which will be the ultimate irony.
Peter, that's well said. In Zambia, how are people remembering Robert Mugabe?
Well, Robert Mugabe, as I said, is a polarizing figure. So in Zambia, like anywhere across the world, there are two kinds of people. There are people that see Robert Mugabe's demise as basically retribution, or basically as finally he's gone. And the other people that look at Robert Mugabe as this gallant African leader who obviously stood for what the great leader stood for, which is a liberated Africa, and also stood for his people. So he's a hero and a villain at the same time.
Well, Paul, Peter, thank you very much again.
Okay, thank you, James.
That was Peter the Pundit Longu of Lusaka, Zambia. It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you, James. We begin the sports with results of matches played in the second leg of the preliminary round of qualification to the group phase of the FIFA World Cup Qatar 2022 on the African continent. Ethiopia booked their place in the next round after an away 1-1 draw against Lesotho in Maseru. The Warriors advanced on the away goal rule after a 1-1 tie on aggregate. In Dar es Salaam, Tanzania's Taifa Stars progressed to the group phase with a 3-0 post-match penalties win over Burundi in the second leg of the preliminary round of qualification on Sunday. In Freetown, the Lone Stars of Liberia lost 1-0 to Sierra Leone but still progressed to the group phase on the 3-2 aggregate. But the match was not without an incident as a chartered bus carrying the Lone Star fell into an ambush of stone-throwing Sierra Leoneans on the main pitch inside the stadium in Freetown. The team had been scheduled for an afternoon of private practice at the stadium ahead of Sunday's match. My colleague James Batty spoke with Sierra Leone's Information Minister, Mohamed Rahman Suare, who said President Julius Boy paid an unannounced visit to the hotel of the Liberian team to express his disgust and assure the Liberian delegation of their safety while in the country.
We understand that these countries are sister countries. We have had a long, enduring relationship. So for us, this was a family affair. His Excellency President Bill paid an unannounced visit at the Radisson Blu Hotel, where he addressed both officials and the Liberian national team, assuring them of their safety, assuring them of the right enabling environment so that they can play the match in peace.
And now to basketball news. Nigeria has booked a slot to the Tokyo 2020 Olympics after win over host China 83-76 on Sunday at the FIBA Basketball World Cup to confirm their place as the best-ranked team in Africa. This will be Nigeria's third consecutive Olympics appearance after they made their debut at the London 2012 Olympics before returning to the big stage at the 2016 Olympics in Rio de Janeiro as the reigning African champions and finishing 11th. Ike Diogo is the team's captain. He reacts after the win over host nation China.
Both teams had an Olympic bid at stake, but I felt like as the tournament went on, we got better and better, and we said that when we were in a moment like this, like when we were up by 8 points with 5 minutes left against Russia and we squandered the lead away, that we were going to get a chance to redeem ourselves, and that's what we did today.
The Tigers coach is Alex Mora.
I'm proud of these guys. I'm proud of all the players that represented Nigeria. We have one of the best talent in this tournament.
And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good day. Briefly, before we leave you, summary of Africa news. South Sudan rebel leader Riek Machar could make his first visit to Juba today, Monday, since fleeing the country in 2013. And that is it for this Monday, September the 9th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting your week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Botte in Washington, wishing you in Africa a very, very productive week.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, the biggest threat to President Yoweri Museveni's re-election in 2021 may be a 37-year-old musician. The future of Uganda on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Join your host, Larry London, for Border Crossings, VOA's Worldwide Music Request Hour, every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in to hear your favorite songs and artists, win prizes and giveaways, and get the latest scoop from exclusive celebrity interviews. Send in requests to our Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram, or call 202-618-2077 to have your favorite music played for the entire world. Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal.